the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Mississippi Rice Situation Podcast, and I'm sitting down today with my good friend and yours, the one and only bald pathologist. How you doing?
I'm great. Afternoon, y'all.
Is it afternoon already?
I reckon.
It rained so much, I just couldn't see the sun come up, so I didn't know if it was still yesterday.
It did, but honestly, if you were a meteorologist, I'd be having a conversation with you about a big old swing and a miss on that one. We called for 5 to 8 inches of rain, and we didn't even get close.
Well, you know, I had a friend this summer send me, I guess you call them a memes. Is that what they are?
I believe so, yes.
But it said, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, I guess you're a damn meteorologist.
That'd be about right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, they tend to swing and miss more often than we do. But that's the nature of their work, right?
I guess.
But yeah, I'd much rather prefer the 3 inches we've got in the delta accumulated over 2 days rather than the, oh my God, it's 8 to 9 like they were talking about.
It was a nice, slow, good, heavy, hopefully that got good irrigation type moisture or good beneficial moisture to roots, not necessarily irrigation moisture, but we did get good deep penetration because it was prolonged.
Yeah, yeah,
definitely. Light rainfall,
it
which
was
good.
One of those good, slow soaking rains. That's what I like to call it. But with that good, slow soaking rain brings into the rice world one of your favorite things to talk about, which is that disease triangle.
Oh, yeah. We spent a lot of time talking about that this time of the year because lots of people have been calling the last few weeks and saying, you know, it's been hot and dry or the weather's not necessarily conducive for things to develop, but you add a little bit of that free moisture. And as I like to say all over Twitter and everywhere else I go, just add moisture. That tends to make things happen.
And we've got plenty of it now, so prior to this rain event, I was getting a lot of calls about rice blasts starting to show up in our extremely susceptible varieties, two of those which are grown on significant acreage here in Mississippi, which are Rex and Thad.
And I had seen some pictures, and I know you and I had discussed those, and really it's hard to tell symptoms and photos. I mean, a lot of people give me a grief about, you know, well, you hate pictures. I said, no, I don't necessarily hate pictures. It's a lot of the time the picture doesn't do a good job of representing what's going on in that field, which in a lot of cases is why we put boots in that field to look at things and double check and make sure. Plus, the other thing is you really have to check spores and what's present within any of those lesions to make sure that the right fungus is developing so that you're not producing a misleading suggestion as to which disease is present in that field, if it's a disease at all.
That's correct. And, you know, a lot of diseases, unfortunately, especially when we're talking about blasts, can also look like a lot of herbicide drift issues.
That's right.
So more important to put boots on the ground, figure out what's going on before you make that application. Now, we were in a field in South Washington County the other day where it was bona fide blast. And we made an application to that field. And let's just talk a little bit about the leaf blast phase and when does rice blast in general start becoming, can I say, deleterious to yield? And when do you need to consider making applications?
I think the thought process is typically that neck blast is the much more damaging phase of that particular disease. And I have to be honest, that's not necessarily an easy call to make because one would presume that you might have leaf blast that could develop into neck blast. But in the years that we've really been dealing with a lot of leaf blast, I don't think we've seen that occur. And I think in a lot of instances, that probably relates a good deal to prophylactic or preventive fungicide applications that are made automatically. I think those are typically at the right time to reduce the potential risks that could be associated with neck blast, because in most of the situations where I've seen neck blast be a problem, the ag pilot accidentally missed a half of a field or sprayed a little later than normal, and that's typically where you would observe more blast in those particular situations.
Yeah, and it's almost interesting that you say that, because if you think back on it and you think about the acres we do grow to some of the most blast susceptible varieties on the market, in general, And again, in general speaking, we haven't had a lot of issues with neck or panicle blast except in certain scenarios like you're talking about.
That's right. And then I think you get to the end of the year and we can confuse an awful lot of additional symptoms when we start doing a lot of desiccation of soybean fields. And a lot of people assume that what they're seeing on panicles has something to do with neck or panicle blast.
Yeah, and it's safe to say, you know, the leaf blast phase that we've identified over the last week and in several areas is probably leaf blast, at least the ones we've walked in the field. Those guys elected to, like you said, it was time to make their fungicide application in that mid to very late split boot stage. So if they made those applications before the rain, okay, and now we have, I guess, that perfect disease triangle working, about how long is that application going to carry them?
You know, I like to say, if you look at those fungicide labels and depending upon the active ingredients within the specific product, your strobilurin or quinone outside inhibitors typically provide about 21 days of residual activity, whereby your triazole or the demethylation inhibitors typically provide 14 days of residual control. What I like to tell folks is, given the environment, how much rainfall we have, temperature, humidity, and everything else that factors into that, somewhere on the order of 14 to 17 days is probably a pretty good ballpark estimate of how long you're going to get residual activity that will be preventative in nature to reduce
the
occurrence of that disease.
So that sounds pretty good. So the guys that got out before the rain and they were in the proper growth stage, those heads should come out in the next day or so, and they should be protected.
Yes. And I hesitate there because most of those fungicides, and I think the general misconception is yes, fungicides are systemic in nature, but they're only systemic on the plant material that they land on. So if you get droplets that land on a leaf, those don't transfer to what then comes out after that application is made.
But if the flag leaf's out, your flag leaf would have been protected.
You did get good protection on that flag leaf. And therein lies, that gets in a whole nother host of conversations about any of the kernel smut or fall smut that we get telephone calls about, and you and I talk about a little bit here and there, and people say, well, I made a fungicide application. Why did I still get kernel smut? Your kernel smut or those smut-based organisms infect at flowering. So if the application is appropriately timed, you will get decent prevention. But if the environment turns and ends up being super conducive, then you don't necessarily have product where you need it to prevent that affection from occurring.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one thing that we all get lost on a lot of times is, well, I sprayed a fungicide, and we don't consider that, you know, we have different timings to try to prevent different disease complexes.
That's right.
And we just want to say, well, we sprayed a fungicide once, it's good.
Well, yeah, why did I still have a disease occur? And there's a whole bunch of additional factors that really relate to how that occurs. And that is, I'll be the first to admit, a super complex situation and not something that's easy to talk about, A, on the podcast, B, on Twitter and however many characters they give you nowadays, C, in a blog post, and D, when you get 15 minutes on a county program to talk about those things. There's a lot of information to get out there, and it's an awful lot of biology, and I'll be the first person to admit, lots of folks don't like to talk about biology.
More folks like to talk biology than chemistry.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you got one up on me.
Yeah, very true. Yep. And I didn't love chemistry in college.
Hence, you're a biologist.
For the most part. That's right.
Well, good, good. That's kind of where we're at right now on blast. Just keep in mind that if you do have a very susceptible variety, you need to be scouting intently now, would you say?
Absolutely. And you know, the easiest thing to really key in on is look at lots of lesions on leaves and look for those that are typically diamond shape in nature. Those are your more classic symptoms associated with leaf blast. And I realize that that's difficult because there are a lot of herbicides that will produce a very similar symptom. And you cannot just make the statement that any fungi that grow within that lesion on that leaf could be blast-esque. The hard part is you got to pull that into the lab and start pulling spores and make sure that they line up and all the rest of that.
Right. So proper scouting, proper identification. If y'all have any issues with that, just get a hold of me or Tom, and we'd be glad to come out and look at it. Moving on, I guess, this has been a really light sheath blight year to date. I know I haven't hardly received few calls, I would say, about sheath blight. Just started picking up in the last week. What's been on your radar, Tom?
Not much yet. You know, it's been pretty quiet for the most part. I've not gotten any calls about that, but I suspect that's going to change after the rain and people start getting back in the field and looking at things.
Well, we really hadn't had the environment until late with the long leaf wetness period.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you add to that situation whenever you're talking about paddy rice, you got plenty of humidity that's down in there. But then when you add additional.
To put the lid on it, humidity.
Absolutely. The stifling humidity that we can typically get in the Mississippi Delta throughout the summer.
Yeah, and I think another thing, and this is just one of the observations I've made about 2 weeks ago, when we generally start to see a lot of sheath blight occurring, we saw a lot of yellow rice occurring. And we've got a lot of rice that's lacking in sulfur and nitrogen, and just due to the environment we've grown rice in this year, it's had some nutritional issues that has probably reduced growth some. And we always know that disease is worse when you have a big, robust, over-fertilized plant. So I think that might have led to some of the issues or non-issues we've seen with sheath blight this year.
But I suspect that's going to change here.
Oh, yes, all going to change because now we're getting our mid-season fertilizer out. Now the earliest rice is going to head and stuff is starting to look better, you know. I guess the other topic that I wanted to talk about is, you know, it always comes up, how do you deal with fungicides on a hybrid?
Yeah, we probably don't talk about that as much as what we should, because I think most hybrids do have a more tolerant disease package or a stronger disease package.
Very, very strong disease package in comparison to some of the things we grow around here.
And I think not necessarily cautionary tale, but one there I think is that, you know, scout and make a fungicide application as needed. And I think a lot of that may end up being related to field history and how much rice production has been in the general mix within that system, because I certainly don't think we have a lot of continuous rice.
Now, outside of Tunica County, you know, there's just not a lot of continuous rice in Mississippi.
That's right. And that definitely benefits and reduces the amount of inoculum that you should have there to reduce the potential associated with those diseases. But whenever you factor in environment, that's all kind of a moot point.
Yeah, and if I remember back right, you know, one of the first times that I saw, you know, fairly large amount of sheath blight on a hybrid variety, it's always on the edges, always where you double drill, double fertilize. And you and I walked field in Bolivar County that one year, and you saw it there. But every time we went back, it never really progressed up to plant.
That's right. It wasn't moving up to the higher levels that it does on some of the other varieties that we tend to plant in this state.
Yeah, so general thoughts is scout, use proper scouting procedures, and just don't run out there and spray it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Where in a lot of cases on our conventional inbreds and Clearfield inbreds, we're running out there and spraying, you know, prophylactically.
We tend to make a prophylactic or preventative automatic fungicide application at a given growth stage, and that has been really beneficial. And that tends to be to manage sheath blight and the organism that causes that, Rhizoctonia solani, your Strobilurin or QOI products are more effective on that particular organism. Even though I know there are a couple of triazoles, at least there's one in particular that's labeled for that. It's not a beneficial fungicide. But to say the vast majority of our acres receive probably an automatic dual mode of action application. And that's been extremely beneficial at reducing losses associated with sheath blight.
And worked very well for us in the past.
That's right. And then, you know, you do get into the conversation about development of fungicide resistance, and that's something we came across the first instance of fungicide-resistant or QOI-resistant Rhizoctonia solani last year in one particular situation that was multi-year rice production, no rotation, you know, the typical situation that you would expect that you would run into that, and they'd been making multiple applications of a QOI-based fungicide annually. And at that point, they called us and said, you know, hey, we're seeing a tremendous amount of sheath blight following two applications of a fungicide. Why is that? Syngenta collected isolates, I collected isolates, and due to just, you know, craziness with harvest and everything else, Syngenta did the bulk of the work there and did the screening and determined that those were not as sensitive to QOI fungicides as what they would be in a situation where they would respond and not be resistant.
And that was our first occurrence of QOI resistance in the state of Mississippi.
That's correct.
And to date, that's the only field that we're aware of.
That's right. That's the only one that we're aware of to date. And I think that's a really good cautionary tale that if we adopt really good best management practices and we rotate and attempt to not make multiple applications of a fungicide that contain the same active ingredient, I think that can reduce the likelihood or the spread or additional instances of fungicide resistance from developing within the state.
You know, they have a huge problem with this in South Louisiana, correct?
That's right. A big issue in one given production area there that, if I'm not mistaken, is pretty much right around Crowley, Louisiana, which is where they have traditionally grown a lot of rice. And, of course, there we did end up with some questions following the instance in Mississippi about, you know, well, what could we rotate to? Can we rotate to soybean? And that's definitely a good rotation, of course. Rhizoctonia solani that causes sheath blight also causes aerial web blight in soybean, but that's not typically a disease that we run into in the Mississippi Delta just because we have bigger, wide-open fields and we get a lot more airflow across those. It's not like East Mississippi where fields are smaller, typically surrounded by trees on three and four sides, and some of those other inherent characteristics of field situations that really play into development of that particular disease.
So it's fairly safe to say today that we're not spreading in the state of Mississippi based on the information we have today?
Absolutely. I don't think we're seeing a large increase in fungicide resistance, but I think that's always something that we need to be aware of, and certainly something that if you see some situations in a particular field setting that make us aware of that, and we can get isolates tested and keep track of that, because I think that's important to protect our farmers and also protect the rice industry in general in the state of Mississippi.
I agree. We can't have very many slip-ups. Hopefully that rice acreage will come back up. Well, you got anything else you want to say?
No, I think that's about it for now.
It's
been quiet for the most part.
It's been a very quiet rice year outside of a few minor calls. This year is, I hate to say, it hadn't run smooth by any means, but on the disease front, hadn't had a lot of calls.
No, not many at all.
All right, guys. Well, we appreciate y'all listening. If there's anything you have issues with, trouble with, or just want us to come look at a field, give Tom or I a shout.
Thank you.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.